The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Now through April 15th, NetSuite is offering a one-of-a-kind flexible financing program. Head to netsuite.com/earnings right now. netsuite.com/earnings.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It's packed with benefits to help unlock more value from your business purchases. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
And welcome to What Goes Up, a Bloomberg Weekly Markets podcast. I'm Sarah Poncek, a reporter on the Cross Asset team.
And I'm Mike Regan, a senior editor on the markets team.
This week on the show, we're going abroad. The Brexit saga continues and civil unrest is growing across countries and continents. What does that mean for markets? We'll also talk credit and we'll discuss whether or not some cracks are actually starting to emerge.
And of course, speaking of cracks, we'll talk about the craziest things we saw in markets this week.
I see what you did there.
You see what I did there?
That was good.
Okay, I'm glad someone saw it. But Sarah, as you said, we're going to take a look abroad for much of today's program. I also do want to get sort of a temperature check on the U.S. stock market. And luckily for us, our first guest is a guy who can speak with authority on all of these subjects as a expatriate Brit, as a expert of LatAm markets from spending some time in Mexico City for the Financial Times. The only thing missing this week is a Red Sox appearance in the World Series to make him the absolutely perfect guest for this week. And I hate to rub that in, but John Authors, welcome to the show.
We can live with it. We're not like Yankee fans who needs the championship every year to justify their existence. I'm very happy to live in the aura of last year. Yeah. That's fine by me.
As a Phillies fan, I'll take once a century.
Once a century. Okay,
right. That was John's way of rubbing the rough Yankees loss in.
Yes,
that's right.
And caught what I did there.
She catches everything. You can't get anything past Sarah. Also joining us this week. Now, Sarah, let me introduce this guest by saying I'm thinking back to 2016. There was a lot of concern about the so-called turn in the credit cycle. And as a guy who's covered stock markets for way too long, I can tell you stock market people get very nervous when they hear about a potential turn in the credit market. I think the thinking is that fixed income investors are a little bit smarter than your average stock trader. They see things coming down the pike. But anyway, Lisa Abramowitz and I at the time wrote a column for what was Gadfly then. It's now part of Bloomberg Opinion. But we made the quip in the beginning that maybe we'll both be in retirement homes when this credit cycle finally turns. I got to say, it might be time to call the retirement home. Get me some slacks with the elastic waistband. And I don't know, a nice easy boy, because I read something today.
You're making everyone nervous.
I'm making them nervous. It's drama. I read something this week that makes me once again wonder, is the credit cycle turning? Dun, dun, dun. But to help us get through that, we're happy to have a first timer on the show, a longtime listener, I hope, Molly Smith from the credit team. Welcome to What Goes Up.
Don't get those pants just yet. You're good. The credit cycle is, those baseball fans out there want to say, is in its 9th, 10th, whatever inning we're talking about. So we're just going to keep on rolling.
This is DiMaggio's streak, is it?
Okay. But John, before we go abroad, I do want to start with you and just sort of get your sort of 30,000 foot view of the U.S. stock market right now. I know you were a little bearish this year based on valuations, but I feel like you're sort of coming around to the bull case a little bit. Walk us through how you're looking at this.
That's questionable. I've been too incorrectly bearish for too long on U.S. stocks to capitulate totally, because I know that if I truly capitulate, that will be the moment when we make the peak. You know, this is something that all market reporters sort of, it's the prayer that you start your day, Lord, do not make me into a contrarian indicator. So No, I continue to think that in the very long term, if you're talking about the kind of people who read us are most interested in long-term asset allocation, it's very, very hard to be excited about US stocks because any sensible measurement, they are historically expensive. And the only reason they look like a decent buy is that they are relatively cheap compared to bonds and credit. Yeah. So that continues to be the case. What I think it probably is fair to suggest is that there is just so much negativity, so many genuinely really good reasons, excuses, but also reasons to get the heck out of the stock market. And instead, we are still very close to this sort of invisible lid of about 3,000 on the S&P, that does suggest that once a few good pieces of news came in short term, that's got to be a good reason to think that the pain trade will be, particularly for people like me who've been telling you to get out of the stock market, that the pain trade will be up on the stock market. So tactically, no, I don't think there is good reason with what we know now to be hugely bearish. Long term, if you've got a choice between Haven assets, or if you've got a choice of other equity markets around the world in which to invest for the next 10 years or longer, I'm still bearish about the US stock market.
John, one investor over at UBS said something to me that really struck me this week. Mm. And he said, the pain trade won't just be stocks going up. The pain trade will be a potential rotation. And we've been hearing about this now for a couple of weeks. And we've started to see some strong performance in the likes of banks and the likes of energy shares. Do you get the sense that this is something that will actually be sticky and we might actually see this take over? Is it still just way too soon to tell?
It's too soon to say, but we did have about a month or so ago now, we had the quantpocalypse or whatever you want to call it, when the momentum factor really did have quite a severe crash. That's the whole point of momentum. It works most of the time and very occasionally really crashes. But the fact that that happened is an indicative that something may be ready there for the turn. Value stocks is another one of those things. I consider myself a value guy. The number of times it's looked as though value is ready to turn and take over again in the last decade is enough to make a grown man weep. It's like waiting for Godot. I suppose it's fair to say that with the passing of time, we must be getting closer to a point of value outperformance. I guess that's fair to say.
And when you think about it, there's a school of thought, and I admit I might be the only pupil in the school of thought, but that stock market corrections can occur on both axes of the graph, you know, not just price, but time. And if the market is basically not that far above where it was in January of 2018.
That's a very, very good point. And I think that it should be made more often, that basically you can make a very good case for the volpocalypse, as I think that was the volpocalypse, that rather than the quantpocalypse, at the beginning of February of last year, really was something of a turning point. That we had a brief melt up after the tax reform, and in many ways, depending on how you measure it, nothing has happened since then. You can also make an argument if you're looking at bonds versus stocks, the classic asset allocator way of looking at it, sort of last fall, when if you remember, we were all worried about yields going up,
right?
One point,
long way we've come.
Yes, and so there's another turning point that has not been returned to when you look at stocks relative to bonds later last year. So I do agree with you. You corrections don't have to be violent, and over the passing of time, you could say we are in a correcting phase. Yes.
All right. So Molly, let's switch over to you. I got to say, I was kind of looking forward to shopping for retirement homes.
I'm so sorry to disappoint.
Time had come, and the elastic waistband pants.
You can still wear them.
They're going to check my get in a couple years.
Code here.
Going to have some suspenders on.
You're breaking my hopes and dreams here. My dad used to do, rest in peace, Joe Regan, my dad used to do the sweatpants with suspenders. That is the power
look for
retiree. That's what I aspire to.
That's the one I'm looking forward to. That. Yeah.
But let me just read something that came out from your colleagues on the credit team this week. And the headline, it's beginning to look a lot like 2009. But let me read the lead. Investors beware, key indicators of a turn in the credit cycle are starting to emerge, reaching levels not seen since the last recession. Upgrades of U.S. companies in high yield markets are trailing downgrades by the most since 2009, according to S&P Global Ratings. So it's focusing on the upgrade to downgrade ratio. Molly, obviously yield spreads are still not screaming any alarm bells to the market at all. But what's your sort of overview from sort of the macro perspective of the credit markets right now?
Yeah, I think when you want to talk about it from a macro perspective, that the more leading indicator would be, what are yields telling you? What are spreads telling you? What are market participants who are investing in these products that would then give you these yields and spreads, what are they telling you? And that's not a diss at all to the rating agencies, but they're not putting any of the money into the markets right now. So it's a bit harder to gauge the pulse from that audience alone. So when we're looking at just talking about how does credit feel right now, is this 2009? Is the cycle turning? It's really hard to say that right now. Credit is having a remarkable year in both investment grade and high yield on the corporate bond side. We're up double digits in both asset classes. And if you've held either of those from the beginning of the year, you really haven't had to touch either. You've made a remarkable return from just holding the index in either one. Obviously, there are different exceptions to that. Like when you look at leverage loans, that's been a sore spot this year. Obviously, a big part of that stemming from when the Fed has reversed course from the end of last year, going from hiking rates to now in a cutting cycle or a pause, at least, and as Jay Powell would describe it. So it's definitely hard to say that this is the turn right now when a lot of deals are getting done, issuance is still strong, and the flows are looking strong too. So people are still buying these products.
Like you said, double-digit gains in IG, double-digit gains in high yield. We've seen double-digit gains in stocks if you only use the year-to-date period. However, we are at a point now where investors seem to be getting testy. For a lot of the credit investors that you speak with, do they seem to be as nervous or jittery, or are they still feeling pretty good?
It would definitely feel like they are definitely feeling pretty good, especially because of when you look at primary market performance, which is the most recent indicator of what the pulse would be telling you. That's the most accurate price gauge out there for where assets should be trading at. And we're looking at really, really strong performance across the board, and that deals are getting done in both investment grade and high yield. Granted, in high yield, these are mostly higher quality names. So we haven't seen a ton of issuance from that triple C bucket, the lowest ratings tier. But even triple Cs right now are having the best run they've had in a year performance-wise. And that is hard to rationalize that against what maybe feels like 2009 from a Raiders perspective.
Is part of it just this giant ball of money? I think that's how Tracy Alloway would call it, the giant ball of money that's got to roll somewhere. And it makes me bring up another piece you wrote this week, the headline being, "With little yield in sight, bond buyers turn to illiquid debt." And it's basically talking about how in investment grade, there is a demand for bonds that don't trade very often, highly illiquid. And how big of a risk is that? I mean, I'm thinking if the payments are coming in, if the coupons are being paid, how much do I have to worry about liquidity in as a credit investor?
If that's all you want, then you don't have to worry. Yeah. And there are plenty of buyers out there that is their mandate. That's the pension funds and the insurance companies of the world, that they are the typical buy and hold community, coupon clipping, not looking to get any kind of price appreciation. And these are very high dollar price bonds, trade that around like the 120 to 140 range on cents on the dollar. So if you're looking to buy at that range in the 140 to 160 area, there's not going to be a whole lot of capital appreciation, right? Because at the end of the day, you're getting paid back at 100 cents on the dollar. So clearly, this is not where you're going to get the big gains of the bond market. And that's where it really becomes like an individual credit picker's market. But yeah, if you just want to buy and hold, go for that all day long. It's a great strategy.
Molly, you also get very involved with the earnings season. And I feel like on the show, whenever we talk about earnings, we always think about the stock side. But you've been very involved in the coverage of Tesla, which did post a surprise profit gain for the last quarter. Also Ford, which lowered its full year forecast. What have really been the standouts? And from the credit side, what have you learned?
Yeah, so those were the big ones, especially auto earnings this week, that it's I think we focus on Tesla a lot for pretty obvious reasons, right? It's a pretty flashy company in every sense of the word, has a pretty flashy guy running it. So when the thing is that from a bond perspective, it's I feel like it's getting increasingly less of a credit story. Tesla is not at all like a massive name in the high yield index, and it's hardly a bellwether of where to sense like how people feel about the high yield market. But granted, even saying all that, like looking at Tesla specifically, this really is a great sign for the company, and that this is to see that they're posting now more quarters of positive free cash flow. We're wondering when are they going to finally get to being sustainably profitable. I hold my breath in saying we could be there, because certainly we felt this way a year ago and that didn't turn out to be the case. But it's looking better this time around. And for Ford, unfortunately, this is where you might say to start to say, is this 2005 all over again, when the automakers preceded the financial crisis in a few years later? So with Ford, it's a very different story. And GM could tell you the same thing, that the growth overseas is certainly challenging. And I'm sure we talk about this on the show all the time about the macro challenges in China and Europe and those markets. And it's not the best time to be buying a car right now. And that's where Ford is struggling, has been going on this multi-year restructuring plan, and is increasingly looking like they're going to get another downgrade.
Don't cancel my sweatpant order just yet, John.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It offers flexible spending capacity that adapts to your business. You can also earn up to $395 in annual statement credits on eligible purchases at select business merchants. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
John, let's do a tour of the world here, because yes. I really wanted to talk about Chile. Obviously, we came in on Monday to these alarming headlines. I guess if you were paying attention over the weekend,
yes.
Unlike me, you saw the news over the weekend about these alarming protests in Chile really turning violent. Several deaths. I don't know yes. what the count is now, but a lot of it being pinned on, of all things, the increase of a subway fare.
Yes.
And your headline really stuck with me. You wrote, the Chile unrest has a worrisome message for the rest of the world. And then in your column, you write, if it can happen in Santiago, it can happen anywhere.
Yes.
So walk us through, how alarming should we be? And, you know, one thing to look at this from yes. a sociologist's perspective, but obviously our audience is a markets perspective. So
yes.
So how worried should investors be about this type of thing?
Okay. If you're an investor, it's increasingly the sociological things that are beginning to worry you. It's mm-hmm. Is civil order going to break down in some countries? And that even includes my own home country, which listeners can probably guess is Britain, where things are getting very alarming indeed, as the country still can't work out how to resolve Brexit. Now, in the case of Chile, it is, by an order of magnitude, traditionally the calmest, stablest country in the region. It did have a very unpleasant dictatorship for a while. That was a stable dictatorship. It had had the longest continuous democracy before Pinochet took over, and it has had a stable democracy without pause since Pinochet fell peacefully. So it is the stablest country in the region. It is, by any sensible measure, the wealthiest country in the region. And one of the critical points, which is why this is alarming for a lot of the markets type, capitalist type people that we talk to at Bloomberg, is that it's the country in Latin America which has done things exactly the way your average markets person, your average Washington, D.C. policy wonk would think they had to do them. Under Pinochet, you did have, they're known as the Chicago Boys, a group of people largely trained under Milton Friedman at the University of Chicago, established a way for Chile to work. And that plainly does have a lot to do with why Chile has performed better than most of the rest of the region for a long time. The pension program that they basically, many people would say, a better version of the 401k, a better thought through version of the 401k, which they established in the late 70s or early 80s. And that's one of the biggest things that people are now protesting about, that we're having the first wave of people who've really been on one of these pension plans throughout their working lives. And I've had plenty of emails from Chileans, $200 a month pensions.
Wow.
For people who've worked as engineers for 35, 40 years. What is also very interesting, just sorry, the other final point, which is concerning, is that, yes, it's transport fares, which were aimed at making it, helping ease the transition away from carbon fuels. And also there's a fuel price increase, a general electricity price increase. All over the world, that tends to be the catalyst when people are angry, including the Gilets Jaunes in France, to make it clear that this isn't just a Latin American story. You've got to be very careful indeed when you make people pay more for fuel, for energy, for transport.
You had a follow-up column as well, and the title was The Big Issue Confronting the Stock Market. And you mentioned Chile, you mentioned Spain, Brexit. And really what it comes down to is what you say is inequality is for companies too. And you talk about moats that companies build around themselves competition-wise, where they can keep building themselves up to be larger and larger.
Yes.
How does this actually affect the process of investing and thinking about markets?
Well, the moats phrase is a beautifully folksy phrase that it comes from Warren Buffett himself. He looks for companies with a wide economic moat. And coming from Warren Buffett, who manages to make being a plutocratic billionaire so charming and folksy in Midwestern, it sounds really cool. But when you think about it, actually, when you say you're building an economic moat around your company, what you mean is you're ruthlessly exploiting its whatever monopoly power it has and entrenching it in a way that you can rip off people for more than you otherwise would be able to rip them off. That has been a process that has been rewarded. This comes back to the long-term bear case for the US stock market. If you look at the price-to-book multiples that people will pay on the biggest five companies in each sector compared to the rest of the market, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but it's like double. And if you look at the profitability of the biggest companies compared to all the rest, again, it's quite startling. The big get bigger, get more profitable, and the rest are left nowhere or with very little to do. The other interesting thing, which might come back to some of the points that Molly was making, there is an interesting debate whether this is about exploiting monopoly power or whether it's about exploiting the ability to leverage yourself up seriously to the hilt. Mm-hmm. Because the leverage, by all the sensible measures, debt to EBITDA or whatever, is of the biggest companies in each sector is, again, off the top of my head, of an order of double the typical leverage for everybody else. The leverage we're seeing in the economy is largely these huge, well-protected companies. And that then leads to policy question, which you don't need to be Elizabeth Warren to think there might be a very good case for splitting some of these companies up. But does that then begin to become the moment when actually the amount of credit we've extended gets very nervous because we've extended them to these companies that we've allowed to get so big they rip us off? And once we no longer let them rip us off, they might also not be able to repay their debt.
But we're still extending to them, so it seems that like that we haven't reached.
So
that.
Maybe we'd better let them keep ripping us off, or otherwise
keep on doing it. Yeah, sure. Right. Let's keep giving them money. It's so cheap. Why not? Everybody's so happy. And I mean, exactly what Mike had said before. There's just this giant pile of money. Where's it going to go? And you have, I'm sure we hammer this all the time. It's the negative yields in Europe and in Asia. And where else are you going to park your money and expect to generate some sort of a reliable return? And right now that's U.S. fixed income and particularly credit that is really proving to be that place.
Molly said the magic word, which allows us to transition into the craziest things we've ever seen this week. She said it, fixed income. And we got a call into the Bloomberg What Goes Up podcast hotline from our own Felice Moranz with a very interesting, craziest thing regarding fixed income. Let's give a listen.
Almost nobody knows what fixed income is. That's according to a Bank of New York Mellon survey of about 2,000 people. it turns out that only 8% of those people could define the term fixed income. It's even crazier if you think about a broader group of people, say people who were unwilling to fill out an online survey about investing. Maybe the percentage of people who know what fixed income is actually a lot lower.
My only question, I wonder if the people who answered fixed income is an investment that pays you a positive yield, if they were ruled incorrect. Maybe that's
okay.
Maybe that explains
the
survey.
People were really just confused when I are truly positive.
Felice had sent me this survey, and you know, it kind of honestly, I'm embarrassed to say this now that I am a fixed income reporter, and I took a fixed income class in college and left that class not really knowing what fixed income was.
But that's a really that's hard on the part of the teacher. Then
the guy actually was a Moody's officer during the financial crisis, so maybe that's has something to do with it. But I have thankfully learned since what fixed income is.
Good
and,
to know.
Yeah, feels good to know what it is.
And as a reminder, if you want to call in and let us know the craziest things that you guys have seen in markets, or ask us any questions, let us know what you're up to, what you're thinking about markets, feel free to give us a call. That number is 646-324-3490. And we may even play your message on the show.
All right. I guess I'll try to top that. I don't know if I can top that. That's pretty good. But on Thursday, so many people in the markets suddenly became fixated on a speech by Vice President Mike Pence about China, because there was concerns that he would say something offensive and blow up the whole trade discussion. So my craziest thing of the week is that people in markets actually paid attention to a speech by the vice president, any vice president. John, do you ever remember traders watching a speech by a vice president?
No.
The last time Mike Pence gave a speech.
Oh, yeah? Okay. What was that? When was that one?
Or he was supposed to give a speech and it was highly critical of China.
Where he was supposed to. It got canceled. Okay. And then it postponed to this. So same speech.
That was the market paying attention to a vice president not giving a speech, which really
right.
is.
That's
really
even crazier.
I think I got one.
Okay.
So speaking after the Tesla earnings this week, I was looking to a convertible bond maturity they have due next week. And in the past, this has been, I don't want to say one of the highlights of my year, but certainly something that we look forward to see, like, will Tesla be able to make this? It's always a question. There's always a bit of skepticism leading up to these. And I looked at it this week and like, man, like they've got a record amount of cash on the balance sheet. I almost started to write the headline, Tesla's convertible bond a drop in the bucket compared to record cash pile.
Wow.
I never thought I'd see myself write that.
About Tesla?
It didn't make it to the print, but I thought it. I definitely thought it for a minute there.
That is pretty crazy.
Sorry, Elon. Yes. It's coming.
Okay, John, how about you? You have a maddest thing of the week for us?
Okay, maddest. Yes. I guess the best example I have for you, coming on from the discussion of the big getting bigger, is that this is a factoid that I found out from Bespoke Investments. If you take what you might call the NASDAQ 2, the eternal rivals Microsoft and Apple, their combined market cap is now virtually identical to the market cap of the entire Russell 2000.
It's unbelievable.
So just these two companies are now basically the same size as what most investors take to be the entire small cap sector in this country.
Well, that is amazing. And that sort of brings to mind your point about antitrust. I don't think that's an issue that's going to go away.
Antitrust, the fascinating thing is that it's one of these issues which unites people at the ends of politics against the middle. It's a perfectly respectable left-wing Elizabeth Warren or right-wing libertarian argument for really aggressive antitrust. And I think it probably will happen at some point, and a lot depends on whether it's actually done well.
Yeah. All right, Sarah, how about you?
All right, so what I have today isn't so crazy, but I think some people will find it pretty surprising, just because when we think about value and growth, people always talk about the demise of value. Is value in a crisis? And people typically think about value in a long, short way, which has not done very well over the last many years, you could say. But if you look at a long only version, if you look at the S&P 500 value index, it actually hit a record high this week, which many people might look at and say, how in the world is that possible? But the fact of the matter is that if you look at that index, it's up about 400% since the bottom of the bull market. Growth stocks are just up even more. And it really just brings you back to the idea that it's really, really hard to find anything that just hasn't done well in this bull market.
Right. And to go to your long short point, it's hard to find a long short strategy that's done well.
Absolutely.
So. Well, that's pretty good. I think I got to give it to our pal Felice Brands with the survey on no one knowing what fixed income is. That's that was pretty startling.
She beat me to it. It's sad.
Get out there and tell the people, Molly.
They should subscribe to the Credit Day Book.
Oh,
by yours truly.
Spread the word. Shameless plug in there for Molly Smith.
Why not?
Oh, wow. That's a good
plug. You can read my newsletter while you're at it.
It's another Bloomberg plug. We're all the same team.
Yeah.
With the plug, though, Molly Smith, Sean Authors, thank you so much for joining us on the show today. What Goes Up will be back next week. Until then, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal, website and app, or wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love it if you took the time to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts so more listeners can find us. And you can find us on Twitter. Follow me at Sarah Ponsek. Mike is at Reganonymous. Our guest, John Authors, is at John Authors, and Molly Smith is at Molly Smith News. You can also follow Bloomberg Podcasts at Podcasts. What Goes Up is produced by Topher Forges. The head of Bloomberg Podcasts is Francesca Levy. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. You can earn 4 times points on your top 2 eligible spending categories every month, like transit, U.S. restaurants, and gas stations. That's the powerful backing of American Express. 4 times points on up to $150,000 in purchases per year. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy, of advancing and expanding education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.